share market,
the S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that loves to be fourth time lucky.
It's a bit of a cryptic opening for you.
Very cryptic.
I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, is the voice you just heard, Dr. Anirban Mahanty. How are you, Doc?
Good day, Captain. I'm good. How about you?
I'm excellent. Any better, I'd be twins, mate.
Oh, you need to come up with a new line.
Do I?
Yeah. Right. I've heard that many times.
I'm nothing if not consistent, mate.
You're very consistent.
That consistency, see?
That is true.
I'm not boring and repetitive, just consistent.
Consistency is important in the stock market, right?
So. Speaking of which, let's get consistent and go through what we're going to be talking about today. More rate cuts possibly on the horizon. You're a bit excited about that.
Or not.
My bank this week cut my mortgage rate. Pretty excited about that too. I might rant about that a little bit later. We're also going to talk about some retail struggles. We're going to talk about Vocus's fourth time lucky. That's the hint of the opening. We'll talk about Afterpay's run-in with the regulator. And if we have time, well, of course we'll have time, we'll get to some of our favourite part of the podcast, the mailbag from our wonderful listeners. Thank you for listening and thank you for corresponding. We're going to get stuck right into the mailbag after we cover the news and views from this week. Let's get into it.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, my bank on, what day is today? Friday, go back to Wednesday. Let me know my mortgage rate's dropping by 0.25%. A shout out to the wonderful Sydney Credit Union. I'll give them a rap because they passed on the full rate cut. Unlike some people, ANZ. that was pretty good. I felt pretty good about that. And now you tell me this morning, I might get another one in the Christmas stocking.
Well, you know, I'm not really saying anything.
Oh.
All I'm saying is, I don't know.
Tell me the story. Apparently, there is some talk about more rate cuts coming down the pike.
Yeah. So, at a very high level, the unemployment numbers came in at what,
5.2%?
Yes. Basically steady.
It's pretty good.
Pretty good. But here's the problem, right? Most of the jobs are being created in the part-time sector.
Right.
People who want to work as many hours as they want to work actually are not getting that.
The underemployed. Right.
That's number one. And number two is like the rest of the world, it seems like our governor basically thinks, or our Reserve Bank basically thinks, that we should be heading towards 4.5% on unemployment rate, very similar to where actually US is below 4% or something like that right now. Unless we head in that direction, we're not going to have the desired inflation impact that they want.
Now, mate, I don't get this. So, I'm old enough, and I'm probably older than you, or at least I look older than you. You still look like you're about 24. Thank you very much. So there was a time when, look, 1985, right? Let's just pick a date. Let's pick a year. If you'd have offered somebody 5.2% unemployment, they would have said, A, thank you very much. I'll take it with both hands and don't complain. And by the way, that's probably full employment. We find ourselves now an arbitrary 34 years later. Oh, jeez. 34 years later, I'm feeling older. And all of a sudden, that's now not good enough. That somehow, all of a sudden, growth isn't good enough. Rates aren't low enough. Unemployment's not low enough. I know Phil Lowe, the governor, knows his stuff, and I know the econocrats know their stuff, and I just can't help but feel like we've kind of gone a bit, you know, it's a little bit FOMO these days, a little bit, you know, like what was wonderful once is not just now okay, but downright kind of not good enough. What's going on?
Yeah, so I mean, part of that is, you know, I think the impact of technology, right? So I mean, technology has made, in many ways, like, you know, Steve Jobs
has killed unemployment. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, so Steve Jobs has probably done his bit, right? I mean, Steve Jobs has basically floated all these different companies indirectly, you know, the Airbnbs of the world, the Ubers of the world, the Facebooks of the world. So all these different companies that basically run on a mobile platform. Sharing economy. So it's easier to find these sort of part-time jobs these days, right? So therefore, maybe the desire for people to work actually has gone up. The cost of living is commensurately gone up. People want maybe dual income, you know. I mean, the unemployment rate is also, you know, the function of how many people are actually looking for jobs, right?
Yes. So, which is also, I think the participation rate, as the econocrats call it, is about a record high-ish.
Right.
62.6 or so.
So more people want to work are working to, you know, afford the cost of living that is today. But at the same time, I mean, I think the current thinking is that if you don't drop that unemployment rate below whatever number it is, you're not going to get the inflation that you want. If you don't get the inflation that you want, that's, you know, I mean, the question really is, what is the right inflation number, right?
Right.
That's also basically a number pulled out of somewhere.
We're going to have to change that too, I reckon. Yeah. So, the RBA has traditionally said 2-3% is their target range.
Yeah.
Hasn't been there in a very long time. I think it all since the GFC, I don't think.
Probably for the last 10 years, yeah, it's been under that number.
I have a sneaking suspicion that the issue is not the inflation rate, but the inflation target.
Targeting, yeah. So I agree with you that the US too is not getting there. Well, actually, US maybe have recently hit like somewhere around 2%, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe all the developed economies are at a state where maybe your inflation is like this is 0 and 1%. Maybe that's your target range. So part of that is the problem. But the other, I think the thing is that some of, in at least for our economy, some of the industries are taking it hard, right? So it looks like house price falls have put some jobs at risk, right? So that's one thing to think about.
That's the big watch out, right? Because the construction industry is a big employer.
Exactly.
They reckon, they being the people who are supposed to know these things, reckon every dollar spent in construction is worth about $6 in the wider economy. So you think about painting and new carpets and clothes and the things that go with that. Plus the fact that if you employ someone to do that carpeting, they then spend their money.
Exactly.
So the kind of multiplier effect is considered about 6-1. If house prices fall, construction falls off, that's a potential leak for the economy.
Exactly. Yeah. And the other thing is, like, you know, in terms of like, you know, various like states and territories, in terms of, you know, what the ABC was reporting, ACT reported the strongest. So that's basically just all government jobs, right? So the, you know, I mean, the government can only create so many jobs in ACT. So there are some, you know, and the retail numbers that we have been seeing and this, you know, the business spend that we are seeing. So there's some worry in the economy, and the worry could feed itself, which is the other problem.
Our economy is so big now and frankly so reliant on discretionary spending. We were talking about this in the office the other day. There's so much reliance now on the discretionary dollar. So if we live in a subsistence world where we eat everything we grow, there's no surplus, right? And and frankly, if, you know, if the economy tanks, we still need to eat the same amount of number of carrots and the same amount of beef and the same amount of, you know, we substitute grain for beef or something. But broadly speaking, all of our income is going to go to keeping us fed. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean we can't be underfed for a period of time, but there's not a lot of discretion in that. There's not a lot of opportunity to cut back in a discretionary sense. We can't choose to cut. They may have to be forced to, but you can't really say, well, I won't spend that this week because I don't feel great.
It's not the new car.
Right. Well, that's the thing. So if you think about the modern developed economy, imagine, so think about our days, right? And listeners, as you're listening to this, think about your day. Think about the few cups of coffee maybe you made at home, but you bought some coffee. You probably made yourself, or you're going to buy yourself a fancy sandwich or a meal out. You might have a couple of drinks after work with your mates. You might be driving a car that's relatively new. You're probably putting premium petrol in that car. You've probably got Netflix on at home. You've probably got a new iPhone. If you had to cut back your expenditure, I would bet, with the exception of bills, so mortgages and stuff, most people, and again, this is not everybody, there will be people listening to us now who feel like they are pretty struggling, and absolutely that can be true, but most of our listeners right now could probably easily take 10-20% of their spending on an annual basis, not necessarily a weekly basis. If you cut back the coffees, the takeaway, the technology, the content, all the things that we cut in the holidays, I reckon very quickly we could save 10-20% of our spending. Now, if you put that on an economy level and say we just have to feel a little bit more concerned about how we are situated economically, maybe we should cut back a little bit. And in fact, in the most recent numbers, we might have talked about this last week, in the most recent numbers, the household savings rate went up.
Yeah.
So interestingly enough, it's not that people have less money, it's they're spending less money because they're feeling less comfortable with the economy. At least that's the inference.
Yeah.
I hope we've got some good news coming next.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Nope.
No good news? I thought you were going to have good.
Well, at least not yet. Nah. So poor old Kmart and Target, mate. Mm. Owned by Wesfarmers. They must hate the fact they bought this business. They bought it with the Coles business. They spun Coles off because investors wanted Coles. No bastard wants Kmart and Target. This is a very, very tough This is a very tough business. So we're talking about discretionary spending. We're talking about deflation. Man, I'll tell you what, if discount department stores aren't the epitome of deflation and cutthroat competition, oversupply, so Kmart, Target, throw Big W in, which is also struggling. The Reject Shop,
yeah.
Absolute basket case. Mm. Mind you, Wesfarmers also bought Catch of the Day and the Catch Group recently, the online kind of discount retailer. So there's something to that, but poor old Kmart and Target. They can't take a trick, can they?
Yeah, they can't. I mean, it's such a tough category, right? I mean, we've seen that with Reject Shop. A, you need to have like rock bottom prices.
Yep.
Right. And then that you, that helps. But you also, in some ways, need to find products that are contemporary or, yep. you know, so you need to find whatever is hot today. So
I know all about fashion. Don't talk to me about fashion. Exactly. I'm the fashion plate.
So you're the fashion. So, you need to, not only that's like, let's use Target, right? And like, for our daughter's stuff, like we go to Target to buy stuff because A, they actually have good products.
Right.
They have trendy products, yep. and they're cheap.
It's a good deal.
It's a good deal, but you know, you can at the same time, you can see there's probably not much money yeah. they're making here, right? Yeah. They're selling stuff at $15 with somebody else, like you know, any other branded place is probably selling at $35.
You buy
right?
$4 and $6 t-shirts.
Exactly. So I mean, but it's a hard gig, I think, and that relies on volume. And I think a lot of that volume or basket size is probably going online, which is why I think the catch group. Purchase yep. actually makes sense.
Yep.
So I think it's just, to some extent, I think it's the consumers, you know, maybe being more careful with their spending. At the same time, I think a lot of that volume is shifting to online. In some ways, maybe we're like, you know, like in the US, it's what, like 12% of the retail online is online now.
Yep. And it's still growing super fast.
And it's growing super fast, right? So, and we are probably slightly behind in that trend. So, I mean, so there's more pain ahead for these guys.
Yep.
So I don't know what to say. I mean,
I'm happy with that.
Well, that's why nobody wants to buy this thing, right? I mean, they want to spin it, but nobody's going to buy it because it's like, you know, it's the market with the headwind. Yeah,
really. It really is. I mean, so retail's tough at the best of times, right? And reasonably, you know, Target and Kmart and Big W have struggled for the longest time. There are simply too many discount department stores in the country. Mm-hmm. Now, a Reject Shop aside, which is frankly its own basket case, but you don't need, these guys sell roughly the same stuff and roughly the same demographic to roughly the same people, and you just don't need, we've never, even pre-retail, we didn't need this many of them. You know, Kmart, Big W and Target, they've never, individually and collectively, they've never been able to prosper at the same time. Either Big W was beating Kmart, Kmart was beating Big W, Target was beating Kmart. It was always that story of someone was winning while someone else was losing. Once upon a time, Target was the shining light. Big W and Kmart were struggling. Then Kmart did its super, super cheap, you know, $4 t-shirts, $2 pair of thongs, whatever they were. It went to the top of the pops. It was a long time ago, but Big W at one point was also the king of the kids. Back in the Roger Corbett days, for those who've been investing for a little while, Roger Corbett, the CEO of Woolies, former CEO of Woolies, started his senior management career running Big W and was doing really, really well there. So it's one of those stories where, you know, for someone to win, someone else has to really, not exactly fail, but do badly in this, in this space. There are just so many stores out there. You rightly point out, mate, between the, think about the Amazons, the Kogans of the world, the Catchers of the world, the idea of kind of almost permanent discounts, and also too, to some degree, the kind of need or the want that was satisfied, the bargain shopper. So if you get a quick tangent, if you got a chemist warehouse, right, it's overstocked and the aisles are narrow and the bins are full of stuff. I mean, bins, the display bins, not the physical garbage bins, are full of stuff. And some of us will say, that's a really crappy shopping experience. Other people say, this is a wonderful shop. I'm going to hunt down myself a bargain. Once upon a time, you go to Big W or Kmart, Target, and you'd go and kind of find your bargain. These days, I don't know how many emails you get a day, but I must get 20, 25 emails a day from various sites trying to sell me something on special. And so I can sit on my computer at home and I can buy from any of these stores plus anyone else online. Effectively, you know, my need for bargain hunting and frankly the ability for them to distract my attention and I spend money on something else rather than Kmart or Target or Big W just continues to erode. So I think you're right, mate. I don't see a bright future for this business.
I was going to say actually one thing that, you know, following on what you were saying, but you know, putting it in another way, one of the things with any like retail store is this effect that, you know, you can increase the basket size by putting stuff in front of you.
Yes.
But I think what happens now is because we get put so many things in front of us in so many different digital ways that actually that I think that discretionary extra spend that, you know, okay, if I can get you to buy the, you know, egg for some price at a cheap price, but I can sell you the toilet roll for an extra piece, you know, for a profit, that actually is disappearing. And that's what's making it harder and probably is even harder for, you know, things like fashion, for example. So,
I think so. I mean, so retail, just a quick detour into retail. Retail, generally speaking, the US, they'd say sales per square foot. We'd probably say per square meter, but square foot kind of is the terminology they tend to use here as well, just because it's a kind of a global terminology. The idea of kind of you want to get as many so rent and staff are two of the biggest costs, the two biggest costs other than product, obviously, for a retailer.
Fixed also.
Right, exactly. And so what you want to do is you want to get as many dollars of sales for every square foot you've got, because that does tend to correspond with staff numbers, although it can be different depending on the product. But broadly speaking, you want to try and get as many dollars per square foot as you can. You want to get the highest possible return on that retail space, the rental space you're paying for. Now, that's all great, except that when Kmart goes to sell $6 shirts and $4 thongs and whatever else, you've got to do a heck of a lot more volume at those lower prices, even to stay still, let alone grow. And to some degree, that's why the reject shop is struggling, because it's trying to, you know, everyone's trying to race to the bottom on price.
Yeah.
Not enough people are getting extra customers through the door. And so Kmart probably hoped they'd put the other guys out of business.
Mm.
It hasn't been successful to the degree they wanted to. So now Kmart itself is struggling. Mm. Sales per square foot remains a big, big problem.
Exactly. So the reject shop is the new dollar store.
Well, it kind of always was, but it had to itself. So way back in the day, our listeners will remember, Kmart and Big W both sold branded products. That, you know, used to, a $15 Rip Curl T-shirt or a $25 Billabong jumper or something. So it was cheaper than the kind of the specialty stores, the individual clothing stores, but it wasn't super cheap. So Reject Shop always had that kind of dollar store opportunity about it. The problem really is that Kmart is almost the new dollar store.
Mm.
And so Reject Shop kind of find itself, well, we don't have the best range or the best prices or the best locations or the best service. If you don't have any of that stuff,
hard.
It's tough to make a buck.
Hard.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, mate, we talked about the number of rate cuts that might be coming down the pike.
Mm.
You know what's going to be larger than the number of rate cuts?
Oh, yeah, I have a feeling.
The number of bidders for Vocus. Now, there was a time when telecommunications was all the rage, and we've talked about that before.
Yep.
Vocus has now had a fourth potential bidder. That's not even the best part of the story. The best part of the story is the bidder was AGL, the energy company. It's decided it wants this is the equivalent of Telstra saying, you know what? We're going to go and buy Origin Energy. Or Transurban deciding it wants to buy Optus. I don't have enough words to describe how bizarre this is to me. Are you going to tell me that I'm missing the big picture? I'm not thinking strategically enough, or am I close to the money on this one?
I think you're not just close to the money. I think you've hit the nail where it should be hit.
Man.
Like, I mean, well, you know, okay, I'm going to spin it a little positively.
Do your best.
I'll try my best. For Vocus, I mean, look at the number of suitors. I mean, you know, like people are just lining up to buy this thing.
But
nobody buys it.
Well, that's it, right? So, they've had three people walk through the offices and say, yeah, thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah. Well, maybe they're fourth time lucky, right? I mean, it does look, and it very much looks, I guess it could be, you know, two desperate parties that get together and maybe something good happens.
That desperate is the right word. Yeah. Right? So this is the thing. So three individual bidders have come and knocked on Vocus's door.
Yeah.
Is it two private equity mobs and one telecommunications mob in the past? I think that's the right number.
Yeah.
At least, though, I mean, private equity can go anywhere. They're very much financial purchasers. That makes some sense. Maybe a telecommunications company wants to get bigger, or, you know, it was a Swedish telecommunications mob, I think, was it? Who thought, okay, well, we got some Australian assets. Okay, I kind of get that. They can bring some specialty knowledge to the table. They can get some economies of scale, maybe. And Vocus, I think, asset-wise, isn't a terrible business. At least it shouldn't be. It should have some decently in-demand assets as long as you're paying the right price. What the hell is an energy generator and retailer doing trying to buy $3 billion worth of telecommunications assets? Here's the thing.
It's a utility.
I'll answer my own question. Exactly. That's the answer. Right? They're kind of saying, well, we're a billing company. We're a utility company. Mm. We're used to doing this stuff. We deal with some of the same customers.
Synergies.
Vocus does have an energy retail kind of bit to its business, acquired from Dodo, I think, back in the day, from M2.
But that's just the retail. Like, I mean, they're basically, the retailers. So, yeah. So.
And I would get that. If AGL said, look, we're going to add telecommunications kind of white label retail. You can buy your phone services from us while you're buying gas and electricity. Okay, I still think that's a stretch for it, frankly. I think
bundling. I mean, it's like, you know, you bundle your electricity with telephone, maybe with mobile, and then, you know, all of a sudden you've got like this juggernaut, maybe.
Maybe. But when you're buying the assets themselves, and again, AGL will also say, hey, we're infrastructure players. We know this space. We're good with regulated assets. I mean, I kind of get the If it is successful, that's why it'll be successful.
It's a marriage made in heaven, right? Two companies that are not growing.
Well, that so here's the thing. AGL loses both ways. In my mind, AGL loses both ways.
Yeah.
On the first part of this one, they're saying, hey, let us pay $3 billion mm-hmm. for a tangentially related asset.
Plus take on, $1 billion of debt or something like that. I don't know how much the debt is.
That's aggressive. So the problem is if this bid doesn't go ahead, what they've pretty much said to the market is, we are so desperate.
Yeah.
We have such little opportunity with our core business that rather than give money back or buying another energy retailer or expanding organically or doing anything else, the best idea we had was to throw $3 billion at Vocus. If the deal doesn't go ahead, investors are still going to be looking at this thing saying, well, why do we own AGL? If the business is so, I won't say broken, or maybe struggling is the best word. If it's struggling so badly that Vocus is the best idea, if the bid doesn't go ahead, why do you still own AGL shares? Surely this is the time to say, well, this is a board that's roughly out of ideas, roughly out of growth prospects. Why would you own the shares?
I don't want to be disparaging, but I think...
Oh, I do.
So I'll try to... You know, one of the things I think what happens in companies is like every management team probably thinks that they want to have a build an empire, right? Yeah. So one, you can build an empire by expanding the number of revenue dollars that you're bringing in, but you in the process, you might actually create no value or you might actually create negative value. Mm-hmm. But I think people don't think about the value creation first. I think people think about maybe there's an empire building. But I agree with you. Like, I mean, you know, if this is the best use of $3 billion, either, you know, if your own cash, which they don't have, right? So they're going to do a capital raise, which basically means that they're going to use a combination of debt and shares.
Oh, man.
This just looks like a bad idea. If you have got cash, maybe pay out dividends to your shareholders if you have no better use, right? I mean, pay out dividends. Franked. We still have franking. So we've got franking. So pay out franked dividends. I don't know. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, this is a good price for Vocus shareholders, right?
Well, if it goes ahead. Well, the odds aren't strong based on history.
The odds aren't strong based on history. But yeah, I agree. I think this doesn't make much sense to me.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, the single hottest stock on the ASX, I reckon I could ask 15 investors and they'd all get it right.
Mm-hmm.
The single hottest stock on the ASX in the last goodness knows how long has been...
It's Coca-Cola. Amatil.
That's the best stock in the ASX, not the hottest stock.
Okay.
I don't have a Coke in front of me. I normally do when we're doing this podcast. I'm Coke-free for now.
Oh.
That's not a conscious decision. Trust me, I just didn't buy one.
You don't like the fizz anymore.
Getting straight back in or after the podcast. Don't worry about that.
Like the fizz.
I love the fizz.
It's very fizzy.
Bring on the Coke Zero.
Okay.
Mate, not Coca-Cola Amatil. I own shares. You forced me to disclose.
I will also I'll say that, you know, Coca-Cola is not paying us, or Coca-Cola Amatil is not paying us any advertising dollars.
But it makes a profit unlike Afterpay. That doesn't stop investors paying $6 billion for Afterpay. That's its current market cap. Well, it still is, actually.
What did you not like about the fact
that... Well, it was about 12% higher on Thursday morning than it was on Thursday night because... Financial services regulator, one of them, AUSTRAC, the mob whose job it is to make sure that there's no money going to untoward places, money laundering and that sort of stuff, they kind of knocked on Afterpay's door and said, hey, guys, we're going to do an audit on you. We're going to just make sure everything's tickety-boo, make sure everything's been done properly, make sure you guys are doing the right thing. Shareholders didn't exactly love the news, mate. Sent the shares down 12%. Now, on my maths, that's the best part of $800 million, if I do the maths roughly in my head. That's a fair old shellacking. Now, to be fair, no one's crying poor. The shares are still up 700% over the last 3 years. So it's got some millions it can give back.
That's what I was going to say. It doesn't matter. It's up 8x in 3 years.
It's all house money.
10% is like, you know, you have to tolerate the volatility to get that kind of gain, right?
Well, so here's the thing. This is not just regular volatility, though. This is potentially the regulator. Well, is it? So AUSTRAC are saying, guys, you might have to make some changes here. We might require you to take a little more care, put a little more effort into the way you identify your customers, the record keeping that you use, the disclosures that you make. We don't yet know what the audit will find. Shareholders are kind of worried it might dent the company's business. And I think, you know, I mean, I joke about Afterpay. I'm probably just jealous I don't own the stock. But this is not a non-trivial issue, right? Like at some level, an AUSTRAC finding could put a decent, at least short-term dent in the Afterpay business.
Yeah, so I would say it's a non-trivial issue, but I mean it's not a non-trivial issue. it's an important issue. But at the same time, as we discussed this last week as well, I mean, one of the things to note here is Afterpay basically is giving out small amounts of money to customers. Basically, it's indirectly lending small amounts of money to, or it's actually lending small amounts of money to customers. But so it's hard to perpetuate, you know, like a $10,000 plus type of transaction, which is what AUSTRAC would be interested in, right?
Right. So the money laundering laws, just so everyone's clear, if you make more than a $10,000 transaction, the bank is required to A, know who you are, B, who you're giving it to, and C, notify AUSTRAC that the transaction has been made.
Right.
So that's kind of the threshold. Now, as you say, Afterpay is more $100 pair of jeans than $10,000 bank transfers.
It's hard to do that.
But it's still saying that, look, there's certain requirements made of the big transaction, the big financial intermediaries, so the banks and the like, even the money transfer companies, that kind of stuff. And they're kind of sniffing around saying, we're not sure that we shouldn't be a little harsher or at least more strict with you guys and what you need to do as well.
Yeah, so I think what they're asking for is fine. And you know, they're following what the laws are, and they're, you know, they're making sure that our financial services and our financial institutions and our, you know, basically the health of the economy overall is healthy, and that anything bad, if it's happening, they need to. So this is great. In a way, this is validates that Afterpay is important enough. Now, so here's the bull case. The bull case is Afterpay is important enough that AUSTRAC is interested in knowing actually what they are doing, right? And if there are any, you know, if there are any deficiencies, that's an if, they might get fined, which is okay. If they get fined, I mean, you know, if there's any deficiency, they're going to fix it. And it is better fixed now, especially given that they're expanding into the U.S. So in U.S. and U.K., much bigger markets, right? So any lessons that you can learn now is going to hurt much less. It's going to be painful in the short term if there are deficiencies, but this is great for the long term. And in a way, many times I say, you know, like what I tell people is that when for example, you're doing something and Amazon takes notice, that's actually that's actually an indicator that you're doing something right.
Right. Yep.
In a way, AUSTRAC taking notice and saying, okay, we want to check what's going on is in a way saying, oh, you know, you're an important component now of the credit flow in the country.
Right, and legitimizes.
And legitimizes to some extent.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm supportive of what they're doing. And I don't think, you know, as it's a recommendation in one of our services. You know, and I can understand how it affects the short term and it, you know, pulling back. And also this comes on the back of like a capital raise that they did. And so, you know, people can connect a few things together here, right? So it comes on the back of a capital raise, which was also accompanied by a sell down by, you know, the insiders, right? So insiders actually sold a chunk of shares and the shares went to a big fund in the U.S. So all of those timing things, right?
That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah. So I'm not a conspiracy theorist. In fact, I'm the opposite of that. Most people want to throw conspiracies at me. I tend to knock both of them back. I think people get way too excited about that.
Yeah.
This is pretty close timing was though, wasn't it? Like the sale was what, Monday, and then Thursday came the news on AUSTRAC. Is that roughly right?
Yeah, that's true. Like, but at the same time, you know, many of these things, you know, they don't happen overnight, right? I mean, if you want to do a big secondary sell down, you want to raise capital, you probably have to talk to the banks. Sure. You have to find the fund house that's going to actually take the, you know, be the cornerstone investor that's going to take those shares. So I mean,
even if that was the case, if the company knew something, should they not have disclosed it before or during that process?
If there was something happening, they should have disclosed it. My guess is that they would have, given that it's continuous disclosure.
And to be fair, we're not alleging anything, so I don't want to misinterpret or misappropriate the
So given that we have continuous disclosure, I'm basically saying, well, you know, they should have, and they probably would have. So therefore, there was nothing there to disclose until now. And you know how things leak, right? I mean, even before there's a capital raise happening, you know, we would hear about it on the newspapers before it's actually come out on the ASX. Man. So given that there was no leak in advance, you know, it gives me some more confidence that this is like one of those coincidences. But you know, if you're an investor, and like a lot of people might just be doing profit taking, like, you know, if you have 8x gains in 3 years, you know, you get nervous.
I think that's a good point, Max. I've got to reckon there's a whole lot of shareholders of Afterpay who frankly own it because it's going up.
Yeah.
And I think, You know, that's not necessarily bad. It doesn't even necessarily make the company not worth owning, but it probably just means that you talk about volatility and we kind of laughed about it, but reality is going to be that people who own it either because their brother-in-law told them to, or frankly, there's some fund managers out there who own it because they feel like they should, because how do you not own Afterpay? How do you...
Yeah, how do you not own the stuff that's going up?
You're a fund holder and a fund manager and you're saying to your clients, yeah. Oh, no, I don't own Afterpay. Why not? It's up 700%.
Yeah. Right.
But that being said, some of those are going to be relatively easily scared out of the stock, right?
Absolutely.
That sort of scenario, they're kind of, yeah. Oh, I've made some money. They probably don't own it for really solid reasons in the first place.
Yeah.
And so when some sort of bad news potentially on the horizon, like, oh, get out now, quick, doesn't necessarily suggest the shares are going to go higher or lower in the future. Yeah. It's probably just more a function of, at the moment in particular, the sorts of shareholders it has, which is going to deliver that sort of volatility that we've seen.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a high-risk stock, in my view, right, and it's right. Got to have volatility. And anybody who owns it basically has to be... Yeah, wanting to and appreciative and be willing to tolerate the stomach crunching that comes with this type of company. I mean,
value stocks,
market,
stock market,
index,
share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, from I'm gonna have to do a segue here.
You are the champion of segues.
I know. From Afterpay to the mailbag.
Hey!
In a really seamless and segue-friendly kind of way.
Awesomely. This is like, you know, like you're delivering the mailbag using the segue itself.
Oh, see? It's a meta segue.
It's a meta segue. That qualifies me for a raise, I think.
Mate, dig me out of enough holes, you might get one. Mate, the first question we have, let's move on quickly, comes from Samuel Krieg, who is at 427 Samuel on Twitter. I will give you our Twitter handles in a minute, so grab a pen if you want to do that. Sam says, firstly, I think this podcast is the epitome of fun, self-directed financial education.
This is like awesome. Samuel, like, you know, good day and...
The epitome of fun, self-directed financial education. That's our new tagline.
Yeah.
Motley Fool Money, the epitome of fun, self-directed financial education.
I'm a fan of Samuel.
I'm a massive fan
right
of Samuel.
Right now, like, I mean, fan, you know, Samuel can write these taglines.
There's a decent amount of
we didn't ask him for this, right? And this was not planted.
Well, directly.
I didn't ask him.
Some of our listeners might interpret the fact that we've been asking for praise in our mailbag.
Did we?
Well, I'm sure we didn't, but some might perceive that we do.
Does Samuel have a question?
Does it matter at this point?
Well, I'm looking forward to answering his question if he has. I know the answer to it.
You'll know the answer, mate.
Maybe.
You're good at this stuff. You're the expert, mate. That's why we got you here. Sam says, I was hoping to get your thoughts on the nature of cyclical businesses, such as agriculture, specifically Costa Group and their recent price movements south. Ouch, I remember that one.
Mm.
I like the business as a whole, and the recent announcements to me seem more related to events outside management control. Do you think that in these types of businesses, unforeseen events like this provide good opportunity, or is it best to stay well clear? So before you answer, I will disclose that Costa is a current recommendation of share advisor. So I'll put that out there to declare our interests and conflicts thereof as appropriate. So firstly, mate, before you get into Costa, even before you get to agriculture, cyclical businesses, you don't strike me as a cyclical business kind of guy. Mm. How do you think about cyclical businesses?
This is not something that I specialize in. Actually, every time I've tried, I've actually probably failed. So my strike rate is pretty bad. But one of the things, you know, and this is something that you say quite regularly, is that, I mean, and there could be, like, you know, as investors, we need to keep an open mind. So cyclical businesses are good. I mean, the thing is that cyclical businesses are cyclic, which means their profits are going to basically cycle from highs to lows,
yes.
Right? The best time to buy probably is when the profit is basically at the bottom, if you can figure out what the bottom is,
right.
Or you have a good idea that this is really going to turn now, then the company on multiples is going to look expensive because the E of the price to earnings,
right,
the price divided by earnings, so earnings are low, but they're going to rebound and the price to earnings looks high. That's probably a good point to actually buy.
And conversely, then, you're implying that if you were to buy in a low multiple of high earnings, would be a mistake.
That would be a mistake. So
value investors would normally say buy at low PEs. What you're saying here is with cyclical businesses, they can actually be a value trap.
It could be a value trap. But all that said, I wouldn't think that Costa to me looks like it is cyclical, but also I think it's got growth opportunities in it. So, I mean, there's the other angle is that how much growth is there in that company that you need to factor that in as well, right? If there is growth opportunities, then maybe, you know, you have to account for that in the price to earnings, if that's your valuation metric or whatever else you're using, right? You know, if you're doing a DCF and so on and so forth. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the... look, I like Costa actually quite a bit. And it's not a recommendation in any service that I'm associated with, but, you know, and I'm not saying that because it's in, on Share Advisor or anything. I just think, you know, it's a good opportunity that they've got. It's a hard business that they're in, you know, and things like, you know, whatever the mushroom flies that they had and, you know, tomato flies or whatever flies. I mean, these things are going to happen.
Yep.
So this can be an opportunity if you think that there's growth ahead, right? Mm-hmm. You know, more and more people are having these avocado sandwiches, toasts, and things like that.
So, I mean,
you
know,
and like, we have avocado every day in our house.
Buy two, mate. One for you, one for Costa.
Well, I always buy two because they're almost always. Well, the reason is that they're on a deal always, and you buy two for $5 or two for $4 or whatever is the deal.
Buy four, mate. You can never have enough avocado. It's a wonder food.
So, you know, I think, again, it could be an opportunity. I don't follow that company closely. It's you know, it's in your service. You probably have some comments on that. But that's what I can say.
Yeah, look, Sam, great question. And again, thank you for the positive feedback. I believe Sam said it with the epitome of fun, self-directed financial education, but I might just be making that up. No, he did actually say that. I just thought I'd say it again because, you know, it's nice to hear that we're the epitome of fun, self-directed financial education. So look, here's the thing, Sam. I would separate to some, well, Costa is absolutely cyclical, but it's also volatile for the reasons that Doc's already pointed out, because these things are not even cyclical, they're just kind of random events. So there's kind of two forces at play here. Doc is absolutely right about cyclical businesses. If you know a business can tend to be relatively cyclical, and that means that profits, sometimes revenue, but certainly profits will fluctuate or cycle from high to low and back again. You want to be able to look what they call through the cycle, right? So if you can see evidence of a cycle, and it's been hard in Australia because it's been 30 years since we had a recession. But generally speaking, if you know an industry is cyclical, you want to look through the industry and say, right, over the last X number of years, 5-10 years, what is the average level of profit? Because that's going to give you some sense of what you can expect looking forwards as well. And so you think about, okay, well, if a great one here is Automotive Holdings, right? They're a car dealer. Plenty of brands. They're an amalgamation of a whole lot of car dealerships. You know that new vehicle sales are going to be sometimes high, sometimes low, and sometimes quite low. And you can look back through history and see what the sort of average levels of sales and profitability have been. That gives you a reasonable sense. So Doc's point, if you can time it nicely and buy it at the bottom, then great, do that. If you don't know exactly where the cycle is necessarily, at least take an average profit over the last X number of years. So let's say, pick 7 years, pick a number. Go back over the last 7 years, find out the average level of profitability is, and then pay a decent multiple of that profit. Whether it's high or low now is kind of a little bit arbitrary. Frankly, it's going to give you some opportunities, because if you can buy it for less than that average level of profit, you're doing well. If you buy it for more, then you're probably going to do badly. But it's less about where you are in the cycle and what this profit looks like through the cycle. When it comes to Costa, it's still a buy for us at Share Advisor. And the reason is exactly as you point out, mate. This stuff is absolutely going to happen. It'll keep happening. It's going to be volatile for that reason. This isn't necessarily cyclical, though. It's not like every 3 years they have a mushroom rot or a berry infestation. They'll have it from time to time, every now and again. But they're a diversified global business now, or becoming more global over time. It will happen. So yes, absolutely. I think rather than being cyclical in this case, although it can be cyclical as well, if you get an opportunity to buy because the market freaks out about a one-off, or a not necessarily a one-off, but an irregular event, then that should, we think, hopefully, provide us with good opportunity. So there's a difference there between pure cycle and the sort of one-off events that give you a chance to buy it cheap. I think it's the latter when it comes to Costa. It will happen again, absolutely, so be mindful of that and be careful about how much you pay. But generally speaking, when the market freaks out about something that really is not an ongoing problem, that's normally a good chance to buy.
Motley Fool Money.
Mate, we got a question from a Twitter user who identifies themselves as @blurbman.
Love that.
BLURBMAN, blurbman. I don't know, mate, do you reckon he's in advertising, blurbman?
I don't know, but I love that. I love that handle. It's a great handle.
Thank you, blurbman, for... Now, I'm almost hesitant to read this one out, Doc, because there's no praise at the beginning. Should we just leave it and move on?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's indirectly talking about stuff that you are passionate about.
And that's true, okay.
And you've been, you know, banging on and on about it on Twitter.
you mean nicely when you said banging
on. Banging on sometimes is a nice thing. I don't mean it negatively at all.
You've been boring us all senseless.
No, I mean, that's great. All right. Trying to help people save money.
Never let it be said we only read tweets out that are positive, though we do tend to preference them. Blurbman says, "Hi, Scott and Doc. With interest rates being so low, sub 3.5%, is it more worthwhile to make additional mortgage payments or to make baseline payments and use the additional money to invest elsewhere. It's not that hard to make more than 3.5% returns. Cheers, Blurbman. I do love that. So, Doc, if Blurbman was, again, we can't give personal advice and everyone's situation is different, so we won't tell Blurbman specifically what he should do. We'll assume he's a bloke because he's identified as Blurbman. But generally speaking, how do you think about trying to choose between paying more off the mortgage or taking the advantage of low interest rates and putting the extra cash into the market and trying to earn more than what you'd otherwise save paying off the mortgage?
I think that's a brilliant question. It's a great question and it's a hard one. Yes. Because again, so this is not a personal advice in any way. We can't give that.
Yep.
It's a great question because there's a little bit of personal subjectivity here. You're what right. makes you comfortable, right?
Can I break in for a second?
Yeah.
I know you get better to answer the question, but maybe you guys say this anyway, so I'm probably stealing your thunder. This is one of the great things about financial advice, and if you are getting advice from anybody, including us, as you're listening to this, there is always a most rational, most theoretically correct answer to any question.
Yes.
And then there is the answer that is most appropriate for your circumstances, including your history, psychology, fears, goals, aspirations, worries, and they aren't always the same thing.
Absolutely.
And it's really, really important as you're thinking and listening to us, there is absolutely technically correct answer, right? And Doc will probably cover that, I'm sure. But far more useful, and this is not just about interest rates and mortgages, it's about investing, it's about saving, it's about buying a house or not buying a house or renting, it's about using, frankly, debt to borrow, to invest, all those things. There's a theoretically correct answer or best answer, and there is the answer that makes most sense to you. And I say to Doc and the guys regularly, and they're sick of hearing me say it, the best financial advice is the advice that's taken. Mm-hmm. There's no point in me giving advice to somebody saying, this is what you should do, and they go, yeah, no, I'm going to do my own thing. Mm-hmm. Even if it's the technically best advice, and frankly, ASIC might even say, well, you should give the best advice, and we should. What we really want is to give the advice that helps people end up with their best possible financial outcomes. And because there's a human element, we have to make sure we get that right.
Absolutely.
Sorry for the interlude, mate.
No.
Go and tell Bloatman what he should do.
That's absolutely brilliant. Like, okay, I'll use my own personal example without getting into specifics, right? So in our personal case, we have preferred to have, you know, keep some money in the offset account, for example. We could pretty much minimize that as much as we can and invest all that money. We have not done that, largely because it just makes us comfortable, makes my wife comfortable. Right. And if makes my wife comfortable, then it allows me to invest better, right? Because if my spouse is unhappy with what I am doing, then that's already a starting point of problem, right?
Very good point.
And so therefore, you don't want to do that. So that said, the rational answer here is that I would personally think that because it's like interest rates are like, what, 3.5? It's probably going to get lower.
Yeah.
And I mean, 3.5, you can find a mortgage that's probably now at 3.2, right? Maybe even lower, right? Given where the rates are. Mm-hmm. On the market, you potentially are going to get much more, right? The markets historically have done 8 to 10. Maybe they're going to not do that much because they've had a bull run. But, you know, whatever. Like, I mean, if they're going to do even 7%, mm-hmm. you're still ahead. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it does make sense rationally to invest more in the market given this scenario. And maybe, you know, when the interest rates creep back up, maybe you want to unwind some of that and bring it here, and right. and that'll be the rational answer. I think that'd be also the best possible use of your funds. Mm-hmm. You know, putting aside you don't want to invest funds that you need in, say, in the next 3 years in the market, right? So if you put that aside, then it does make sense to invest, maximize. And listen, I'm not saying that just because we are stock market, newsletter service and things like that.
Yep.
That's exactly how I feel, with the caveat, as I added, that, you know, I tend to keep a little bit more than what is necessary, largely because, you know, that's just my own personal circumstances. That, you know, the contrary to that is that I've often dipped into that when I think that it's, you know, market pullbacks. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel comfortable dipping in and investing more at that time. Again, that's just again, a personal scenario, personal, you know, situation. And I think every person is different. But yes, I would absolutely invest because that's where the returns are.
Mate, I think that's perfect. I will add a couple of things. First is don't think about the 3.5% in isolation, because the 3.5% is tax-free.
Correct.
So effectively, depending on your tax rate and working and all that sort of stuff, but if you're making 3.5% or you're paying off your loan at 3.5%, that's probably equivalent to a 5-ish%, 5.5% before tax. So you don't have to pay tax on the interest saving on your mortgage. You would have to pay tax on any profit you make from investing. So if you were to earn 4.5%, for example, investing, and you hopefully do better than that, but if you were to earn 4.5%, then potentially you'll actually end up worse off after tax than if you just paid money off the mortgage. So first thing is think about that. The tax situations are different. We never ever say invest or don't invest because of tax. What we do say is look at the after-tax returns. And in this case, the interest savings are tax-free. That's a big win. Second thing I would say to Doc's point a little bit is, I think it's Warren Buffett's line, but it's probably someone else's line. You never want to rely on the kindness of strangers. What I mean by that is the bank really doesn't care whether they throw you out of your home or not. I would always say get ahead of your mortgage repayments, either by paying down extra or, as Doc said and Doc doesn't, I do the same, put some more money in the offset account so that if the worst happens, if I get hit by a bus, if my boss decides that, look, it's been fun, Scott, but we want someone else to do the podcast, you can go and find another job somewhere else. I'm not going to get to the first repayment and go, oh, gee, where's the extra money? Yeah, I could sell some shares and that might take some time and I got to pay tax on the sale. So there's always ways to get some of the cash, but you don't ever want to rely on the kindness of strangers. It doesn't mean take out no debt. It just means be conservative with the amount of debt you have. And it makes a whole lot of sense to have more money somewhere in an offset or extra repayments. So you're always ahead. You've always got that buffer. And you know what? It's a psychic buffer as much as a financial buffer, but both are really, really important. So think about that. Next thing, again, to Doc's point, I agree. That being done, then absolutely go and invest somewhere else. Be mindful of the prices you're paying, of course. You don't want to go and pay over the odds for something that's going to fall by half. I wrote an article this week about lithium stocks. If you want to search Scott Phillips lithium and maybe SMH, throw that in Google. Or Bing, as you like to do, Doc. For
Bing.
God knows what reason.
I love Bing.
If you awesome. Throw lithium, SMH, Scott Phillips. Lithium stocks have lost half their value in the last year and a half, right? Now, it's one thing to say, well, could I get more in the market? Yeah, if you invest well. And again, that risk component. Investing, we think, over the very, very long term, on average, will compound at much better rates than you get in your mortgage. But just be careful. Don't take money out of the mortgage and go throw it in the latest hot stock, the latest marijuana stock, lithium stock, tech stock, whatever's overpriced right now. Again, maybe you'll do really well. Maybe you won't. But just don't, you know, just be careful about how you invest that cash. If you're going to say, look, over 15 years, would I be better in a diversified portfolio than paying off the mortgage? Absolutely. Over the next 2 years with a hot tip from your cabbie, you know what? I think I'd probably pay it off the mortgage if I had the choice. So be diversified, be thoughtful, be sensible, think long term. Again, all the things Doc's already said, but just to reiterate that point. But yes, overall, I think it makes much more sense to invest outside your mortgage because there's simply better returns on offer, as long as you also then pay off that mortgage in a reasonable time frame. You don't go and spend the extra cash. So again, some people can invest and then go and spend that proceeds of the investing on something else. If you're investing for the long term, you're going to keep that money in a productive asset, not decide to blow it on a boat or a car or something else. Again, makes much, much more sense. But just don't fool yourself into thinking, as I've seen some people do, they paid money, invested rather than paying off the mortgage, but then going to blow in the proceeds of the investing on something that doesn't really add value. And so they end up with a depreciating car and the same size mortgage, even though they made some money investing, that's still a net negative decision. And again, I'm not saying you would do this necessarily, but in terms of thinking about how that might work, those are some of the considerations. So Blue Band, hopefully that answers your question. Again, thank you for the great question. Thank you for the great handle. Not so great on the lack of positive feedback and reinforcement for us.
Yeah.
We're nothing if not narcissistic, Doc.
Well, but, you know, next time.
Next time.
I hope you're on, Blurred you're Man, especially, has got such great handle.
We would never ask for it. We'd never require it. We just want you to know that we feel better when you give us some nice words, and we feel a little bit sad when you don't. That's all.
Yeah.
So if you really don't like us, don't bother. But if you like us, then, you know, think about how we feel. We have feeling. We're people too.
That's true.
Not just voices in your podcast machine.
No, we're not machines yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Hopefully. When that happens, I'll be actually glad I put some money in the offset.
Exactly.
When I get replaced by the robots who can either come and do this or stock pick or something else, I'll be in all sorts of trouble.
And they'll be walking around.
I've also got some really, mate, we've gone well over time. I've got some great mailbags still lined up for next week. So
awesome. I love mailbags.
Send us some mailbag. If you are interested, if you want to hear our thoughts on something more interesting, if you want to give us some praise, potentially, just hypothetically, no requirement.
Just a little bit.
If you wanted to.
Yeah.
Just completely, you know, agnostic as to whether we get praise or not, but...
And you just give us praise. I think that's just fair.
We're pretty good.
Yeah.
Why would they not?
Actually, otherwise the machines are going to take over. I mean, that's not good for anyone.
This is the highlight of our listeners' week, Doc.
Yeah, exactly. I love it.
Poor people. If you do want to get in touch, at the Motley Fool AU on Twitter. I'm at TMF Scott P. And Doc is at Anirban Mahanti, Anirban Mahanti. You can get us direct mail on Facebook. You can send us an email at info@fool.com.au. Twitter's easier because we can kind of interact and it's a bit more fun. But any of those you can get to us. Don't send us snail mail because I don't even know our postal address if we have one.
No idea.
The company in the US is actually getting rid of landlines.
That is awesome.
Isn't that bizarre?
That is awesome.
I never thought I'd imagine an office where you literally didn't have a phone or even a phone number.
Steve Jobs.
Bizarre.
It's all about Steve Jobs. The world changed because of one man.
I knew I'd gone too long. All right, that wraps us up. But before we go, don't forget you can and should subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app if you're one of the more enlightened people. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a rating, give us a review, tell your friends, share the love. The more they know, hopefully, the better they will be off financially. That's why we're here. That's why we do what we do. And don't forget, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with a full mailbag and a little more foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.